Rita's ready. So here we go. And that sounds, guy, you can hear me now, and I can hear you, I think. So, you know, it is possible and most likely probable that we can wake up one day, a lot of days in our lives, and realize that we have drifted through certain aspects of our lives. We've never really taken ownership of certain opportunities. We've never really taken advantage of certain situations that are a part of our life. And we look at our lives and we think, I know this is what God wants me to be doing, or this is the way he wants me to be. And we look at where we are and we realize there can be a pretty good size gap. And I shared with you last week that we've been kind of working on this series at my other congregation, and we've looked at the fact that people, really, the people closest to us, the people that are in our inner circle, have a great determination on the quality and the direction of our lives. Do we own those circles of friends that we have? Or do we just kind of allow ourselves to drift out and drift into relationships around us? What about your time when you come in here on Sunday mornings? Do you come in here expecting God to do something? Do you come in here believing that he wants to speak into your life, and are you willing and able to respond? Do you come expectant? And last week we talked about drifting into selfishness, where we make decisions based on what I want, based on what my needs are, based on me. And this morning I want to talk to you about one final decision that all of us need to make if we really, really want to own our lives. If you read the Gospels, you realize that you can see patterns in them shortly after you begin reading. And themes emerge about who Jesus was and how he engages with people. One of those themes is that Jesus was interested. He took the time to invest in people who the religious folks had ostracized. People who they said, well, you know what? They have a history. I don't know that I really want to be associated with them. They said they have a history. They have a past. They're carrying baggage. We don't hang out with those people. But people who looked nothing like Jesus liked Jesus, which is the opposite of what some folks today who have been with Jesus' followers might say. They might more likely hightail it away, saying, I don't want to have anything to do with them. But in the Gospels, we can't get away from the fact that folks who look nothing like Jesus liked. They felt comfortable. They wanted to spend time with Jesus. They wanted to be with him. This reality created some tension between the religious leaders of the day who thought there was a certain way to live, and sometimes some of the people in Jesus' crowds who knew they were sinners, who knew they were fallen, who knew that they needed him. Jesus is speaking in one particular occasion, and Luke gives us a window into that tension that began to exist between those religious followers and the outsiders. Jesus is speaking. He's got folks around him who are outcasts. He's got people around him who are religious leaders, people who have wandered from God, who knew their past, who knew they were sinners. And Luke dips into this scene, one particular scene that we read about in Luke chapter 15. He writes in verse 1, tax collectors and other notorious sinners. And you remember I shared with you a couple of weeks ago that you have tax collectors and you have sinners and you have people that work up the scale. You can't hear me, so I'm going to walk back over to the microphone. All right, remember we have sinners, and then below them we had tax collectors. They were the lowest of the low. Charlie, you're here again this morning. It reminds me, what's at the bottom of the barrel? Scum. Remember, we talked about that a couple of weeks ago. The tax collectors and the other notorious sinners. We don't know why they were notorious, but they must have been really good sinners because they were notorious and they came to listen to Jesus teach. I want you to notice that nobody forced them to come. Nobody made them come. Nobody promised that there would be a lunch after church if they came. They came because they wanted to. They wanted to be around Jesus. And this made the religious leaders, the Pharisees, and the teachers of the law, it made them mad. That's right. They complained that he was associating with such sinful people, even eating with them. It was like, Jesus, you can wave at them, but you cannot eat with them. In fact, we would rather not that you even associate with them. That got the religious leaders irritated. The impulse of religion, when we become religious, oftentimes we begin to orient ourselves around religious rules and regulations and traditions. And we begin to create barriers between those who are in and those who are out. We begin to draw battle lines about who's sinful and who's not. Who will we look the other way for? And those people aren't like us. They don't believe like us. And so we don't associate with them, but these people are okay. And the religious leaders were repulsed by Jesus, that he was doing this, that he was striving to have some kind of relationship. In fact, one day they asked his disciples, the religious leaders did, they asked the disciples, why does your teacher eat with such, Charlie? Scum. Right. And they could not even acknowledge, they would not even acknowledge these folks. And you can almost imagine as Luke is thinking back, as he's writing about this encounter, there was a looming question over that scene. And that question was, why? Why? Why would Jesus choose to risk his reputation on people that nobody else would want to talk to, people that everybody else had left behind? And finally, as that question looms, Jesus addresses it by telling a short story, an impactful story. It says, so Jesus told them this story. He said, if a man had 100 sheep, Charlie, did you ever raise sheep? Nope. Okay. Well, maybe we can compare notes afterward with cattle and sheep and figure it out, okay? All right, so the religious leaders were repulsed, and Jesus says, okay, I'm going to tell you this story. He says, there's a man with 100 sheep, and one of them got lost. What will that man do? Won't he leave the 99 others and go into the wilderness and search for the one that's lost until he finds it? Yep. Yep. It's a rhetorical question. Obviously, most of these people either knew a shepherd or had somebody who was a shepherd that was in their family. They understood the economic impact and the economic stability of having sheep and the value that they could bring. Obviously, the answer to the question was yes. You would go out after that one. He'd do anything that would be necessary to find the one. You go after a lost calf. Yep, all right. See, we're already getting there, aren't we? And Jesus had all of those people that were listening to him that day nodding their heads. Yes, we understand. We're on board. They all begin to kind of relive something that they've lost that was important to them, and they reliving that moment. And he goes on and he says, and when he has found it, he will joyfully carry it home on his shoulders. And when he arrives, he will call together his friends and neighbors, saying, rejoice with me because I have found my lost sheep. He isn't going to take that sheep off of his shoulders and put it down and say, all right, guys, let's beat this sheep for running away. He's going to say, no, let's celebrate. The one that was lost is now found. And he's invoking these feelings from the crowd. And as he evoked those feelings, we realize that three things in this story are true that all of us who have lost something identify with. Number one, when you lose something of great value, what is unlost? And I realize that's not a word, unlost, okay? But what is unlost is not as important as what is lost. Take it from me, a guy who moved 2 weeks ago, all right? What is lost seems like it is far more important than that which is found, right? Hey, I'm on with you here. In my first pastorate in West York, we lived for the first few years in a parsonage. And behind that parsonage was a field that year happened to be full of corn. My son was about 5 years old at the time. My daughter was 3 or 4. And my wife and her mom were in the backyard that night with the kids and myself. It was this time of year, so the field was full. The corn stalks were high, and they were brown. And what does my son choose to do that night? He takes off into the cornfield. And I'm thinking there, gee, I hope he doesn't go too far. And all of a sudden, I hear, and everybody in the backyard's all worked up. Oh, my grandson. Oh, our baby's going to die. And I tried to get them all calmed down so I could concentrate on his cry. The only problem was, as he was crying, he was also moving. So I got them all calmed down. Eventually, I got Colin calmed down simply by calling out to him and telling him, hey, buddy, walk towards my voice. And, you know, it took 2 or 3 minutes, but finally I find this little boy all teary-eyed and red but also kind of like, hey, we've already started the next game, finding Daddy's voice. Now, my question to you is this. What was my daughter doing the whole time? What was my daughter doing the whole time? You don't know, right? Neither do I. Okay? Because she was home. She was found. She was not lost. She's good. Now, imagine if I'd have come out of that cornfield and maybe had been searching for 5 minutes and said, honey, I give up. I can't find him. But the good news is, my dear, that we still have Janelle. Now you laugh. You laugh. Because you know it's true. When you lose something of great value, what is unlost is not as important as what is lost. Second point Jesus makes, when you lose something of great value, you will go to great lengths to find it. Luke quotes Jesus as saying, the shepherd will go until he finds it. There is an urgency there. He will go out into the wilderness. He'll go look behind big rocks. He'll find bushes and brush, and he'll be pushing through it, all looking for that sheep. If you know anything about sheep, Charlie, oh, you don't know anything about sheep. Okay. But do you know that those things are stubborn animals? When they get lost, you know what they do? They just park themselves down. They aren't going to move. They are fearful and they feel isolated and they are stubborn. And the shepherd will have to go and look till he finds that sheep. And then he'll have to go down and, you're going to lose me here for a minute, but bend down and pick it up. And he'll take that sheep. We're not taking it back to our friends to beat it. No, he's going to take this sheep that is flea infested and dirty. And he's going to put it on his shoulders. You never did that with a calf, did you? No, okay. So, and he will walk home like that. It cost him something. But you're willing to go to great lengths to find something that is of great value, something that costs you. Which leads us to a third observation. When you lose something of great value, the effort spent looking for that item that is lost pales in comparison to the joy of finding it. Jesus says to the shepherd, joyfully, not begrudgingly, he joyfully, not one of those roll your eyes kind of, oh no, here we go again, brings it back to the community. I'm sure the listeners were listening to Jesus that day and they're like, well, this is great. I mean, we like sheep. We see you're a fan of sheep, but what does this really have to do with us? We love sheep. You're a big fan of sheep, but this really isn't what we're talking about here. This is, you know, kind of the outcast people and the people that think they're the in crowd. It's not about sheep and shepherds. It's about hanging out with and about investing your time. And Jesus doesn't always explain his stories, but this time he does. And it's shocking. It's shocking to the audience that is listening, and it is liberating to others who are listening in. Jesus explains the story. He says, in the same way, there is more joy in heaven over one lost sinner who repents and returns to God than over 99 others who are righteous and haven't strayed away. He's saying, do you want to know why I associate with these folks? Why I invest with these folks and not the religious leaders? He says, I have been put here by God to reveal the heart of God to this world. He has put me here to put flesh and bone on what God thinks about this world, to show you what fires up God's heart. And I want to tell you, it's not the 99. They're home. They're like my daughter Janelle that night that Colin got lost. He said, I'm here to look for the one. Jesus is saying, how else can I respond but to look at those people and to realize their lostness and their need for God? What other kind of response could I give? Now, the religious leaders are there, and they're saying, well, Jesus, we can give you a whole bunch of responses. Number one, we can respond with judgment. We can tell them, they're not our crowd. We're not hanging with them. We can respond to them with disgust. My God, can you believe that? We can respond to them in many ways with contempt or fear. But Jesus says, that's not getting at the heart of God. See, Jesus in that moment begins to rip their categories, and they had a lot of them. And he gives us insight as to how he sees people, how God sees people, and how we should see people. He says, if you have people in all kinds of categories, you religious leaders, you got them here and here and here and here, and what you can and can't do and won't do. And he rips them down. He says, basically, there are two categories of people. He says, you have people whom God loves who are found. And you have people who God loves and who are lost. That's how I see everybody, Jesus said. They're either lost or found, but all of them are under God's love. They are the objects of God's relentless love. It's how he sees every person, and he wants us to see every person in our school, in your family, in your workplace, in your neighborhood, as the object of God's love. Either they've discovered it already or they're wandering from it. But that's the only two kind of people in this world. And as challenging as it was for the religious people to hear those words, I imagine it was life-giving for those who were wandering from God. Because when you're lost, the most important thing you care about is whether somebody else is looking for you. Does anybody really care? Maybe some of you are wondering that this morning. Is there really, really a God? And does he really, really love me after all that I have done? If you do, I want to tell you this morning that God is looking into your eyes saying, you have no clue just how far God would chase you to win you back. You have no idea how much God longs just to pick you up and put you on his shoulders and bring you home. And Jesus articulated it wonderfully. He says, guys, you've missed it. You've drifted into thinking it's about the 99, and it's never been about the 99. It's always about the My greatest fear for the church is not the financials. It's not that the church would burn down. It's not even about the next sermon series that the secretary is waiting for me to give her about what I'm going to preach. And I have no idea. No. My greatest concern is that we drift towards organizing ourselves around being content in the 99, and we forget that there is still one out there looking. Will we join Jesus in the mission of going into the wilderness and seeking out the one? Will we give of ourselves to see more people find hope and light in Jesus? You see, Jesus gave his followers two commands before he left this world. And they were striking commands. He said, as the Father has sent me, so I am. One more time, church. As the Father has sent me, I am. Into the wilderness, because there is one more out there. You turn to the pages of Matthew, the 28th chapter, he says, go and make disciples. Leave the 99, they're good, and find the one. Because he says, that is where I am. And he wasn't saying those words to the church. He wasn't saying those words to an annual conference. He wasn't saying those words into a camera that was being projected to millions and millions of people. He was saying it to individuals, to you and to me. Let's go find the one. We can drift to all of our time being spent with the 99, but Jesus is out about a mission looking for the one. And it means we have to invest and invite. I don't know, I'm sure there's some of you this morning that could look at a balance sheet, could look at your stock portfolio, and you probably go into your computer and just hit a couple of keys and boom, it's there. You know what it is to invest? You spend time and energy and effort. That's what you need to do with people. You need to ask them questions. You need to answer questions. You need to spend time with them. You need to pray for them. You need to invest your life in them. And then you need to invite them. Hey, come on and see what God is doing here at Carlisle. Grow with me. For some of you, when I say that this morning, it becomes very personal. There is a name and a face that you know God's heart is for this morning, and you long for them to be sitting beside you. Maybe it's a mom or a dad. Maybe it's a son or a daughter. Maybe it's a spouse or a coworker or a lifelong friend. You know why Jesus was willing to have his reputation ruined by people who everybody else cast out? That's no way to start a religion. But he didn't come to start a religion. He said, I came to seek the lost, to draw them out of the wilderness. And in to my arms. I don't know who's done that for you. Somebody came along at some point and answered some questions, asked some questions. Somebody invested in you. But you know what I'd like to see? If I could look into every one of your eyes this morning, those of you that don't have them closed, I would love for someday when you stand before God, as will all of us, to hear that somebody else said, you know what? They were so important in my story for me getting here. Gene, I'm going to pick on you, okay? Mike, I'm going to pick on you. Michelle, Agnes, one of those folks was the whole reason I'm standing here today in front of God, because of what they've done, because of what they invested, because of the time they took for me. Heavens, I can look back on my own life thankful for two parents that really took the time. I can be thankful for guys like Bruce Lafferty and Anthony Blair who took time and invested in me. As each one of us could think of those names this morning of people who have invested in us, who might we be investing in? Jesus is out there amongst the wandering and lost. Let's go find him and the ones that he wants us to bring home.